Thank you, Maggie. Welcome, Ed and John and guests that are joining us. I met Ed about 3 years ago where I was a guest at a one-day-long conference and kind of got a sense of the ministry he's involved in. But I want to read you something that caught my eye after I met him. And this is from an article he wrote in April of 2013. When Ed Convoy took over orchestrating the Breaking Bread Meals at Broad Street Ministry in Philadelphia, he focused on developing as many ways as possible to counteract the constant messages about scarcity that their guests, they call them guests instead of members, the guests encounter each and every day, like having to stand in line. The constant lining up for this service or that program is one of the most powerful reinforcers of the scarcity mindset. Lines are also a symbol of political imbalance. The wealthy do not wait in line. They have reserved first-class seats and priority access. Having to stand in line symbolizes helplessness, hopelessness, and the constant concern that there is not enough, and that it will run out just before it's my turn. Ed did something about that. And then the article goes on, but we have Ed right here. Ed, so welcome. I wonder if,
thank you, Peter.
If you could just, I just read that and I thought, wow, that was like a wake-up call to me. And could you talk a little bit about your work and what led up to the... Just introduce yourself a little bit to the callers and to us about what you're up to and what you're up to these days.
I'd be happy to. Yeah, we have a number of different services we have for our guests at Broad Street in Philadelphia. We're at right on the Avenue of the Arts, if anybody's familiar with Philadelphia, right in Center City. And it's an old Presbyterian church, the building, although our program is social service is quite secular. We still share many of the values of some of the early congregants. And so I guess the cornerstone of our service offerings is that breaking bread meal that you talked about. And it's we actually have transformed the sanctuary. It was a very large, old, prominent church. We took all the pews out, and I think that's, Peter, where you were in the engagement. And it's and we have tables and chairs. We have about 200 people who come and sit at round tables and tablecloths and regular dinnerware and silverware, so we don't use disposable. We try not to use as few disposable things as possible, because I think that also gives a message to folks that our guests are disposable as well, and we really want them to have a feeling of being included and being part of something that is vital and vibrant. And so our volunteers come, and we don't have a soup kitchen model. Our focus is on the dining room, not on the kitchen. Actually, our guests never really ever see the kitchen, and the kitchen's in the back, and the food is really not our central focus. Our central focus is on hospitality, and we have a hospitality model, and we think that radical hospitality does lead to radical change, and that's really what our focus is. So our volunteers come and serve our guests tableside, so there's no standing in line for a meal. There's none of those cafeteria style. And our sense is that many of our folks who are experiencing homelessness or housing insecurity and food insecurity and often living on the streets, we have a sense that they've essentially forgotten who they are. And we really want to have a place and an engagement where they can remember who they are as really vital members of our society and our culture, and they matter and we care about them and we notice them, and we want to address the chronic trauma of scarcity in all of its forms. I think that's a nutshell of what we're trying to work with.
That's stunning to me, that to take something so concrete and so, and the idea that no disposable silverware, because we're not disposable. You're offering them the notion that at least that they're permanent and they're here. And then this is a meal of remembrance, which is remembering themselves.
Yes, yes.
Wow.
Well said.
Wow. Just to stay with that, is there other things that occur during the meal? Because then everybody's kind of fed at the same time, aren't they?
Well, yes. We actually, te- technically we have room for 186 of our guests. The room could hold 500 if we had long rectangular tables, if the focus were just on the food and the meal itself. But it's really about the hospitality, so using round tables and limiting the number of people really does create a sense of spaciousness, because that's also one of the senses. Our folks have a scarcity of social space, and social friction is often a concern. So we do have a number of people to come in on a, it depends on, actually, the numbers, we count everything very carefully, and we do see the trends, and the numbers we have will vary from 20 to 25% from the beginning of the month to the end of the month because of the benefits that have been cut over the years. And so, on average, our guests, with the SNAP benefits being cut, et cetera, there's about 4 meals a month that they're missing, so we'll see those folks will show up later in the month. Yeah. So we have more folks that to come in who then we can seat immediately. But the way we handle that, rather than having lines or tickets, actually our founder, he told me very clearly, he said, if we ever have meal tickets, I want to shut the place down, because that's not what we do. So my challenge has always been to not have meal tickets, not have those kinds of numbering system. So we've have a host or hostess that meets our guests and takes their name and greets them, and then we have a second seating area where they can see the meal being served as people leave, and then we have people busing, and then we have the opportunity then to go up to that person and we can say, Peter, your table's ready, and take them to that table rather than having them stand in line worrying that they're not going to be seated. So We are giving them the assurance that when it's their turn, they will have a turn, and so then there's a constant turnover. And the reason it works now is because our guests trust that our kitchen will never run out of food, and we never do. And so in the early days, they would come at the very beginning of the meal. They would come at, you know, for our lunch, they would come at 11:45 to be the first in line, you know, the first to be served, because they would be afraid that we would run out. And so now more than half of our guests will come after the meal has begun, which is very gratifying to us, because now it's embedded in the culture that they don't have to come and stand outside an hour beforehand to be, you know, the first in line. They can come a half hour after the meal has begun, knowing that there'll be a place for them at the table. And that's really why it works, because it's a constant turnover, and the immediate rush isn't there like it might be at some other places where you'll see people standing outside, you know, for quite some time.
And John, I'm just wondering, you've created an environment that has the message of hospitality, and now you have people who once stood in line who are sitting at a friendly table. Do you see any effect upon the people who are at the tables now of this kind of a setting, as against how they might have been when they stood in a cafeteria line?
Yeah, John, we do. I mean, there's a couple things that happens at the tables that, you know, as we try and really learn from our guests who are wonderful teachers for us, if we can just pay attention, they make good decisions in some very difficult situations. And what we find is not dissimilar to what my parents used to experience when they would, as they were older, as they would go to McDonald's on different days. We have guests that sit at different tables at different days. They have different communities where they'll meet on Thursdays and they'll meet on Mondays. And so there is that. That sense of community and diversity. To speak directly to your question, there is a certain amount of time it takes, and we're never sure how long it takes, for some of our guests to become acclimated to the way we do things. For one thing, they're used to standing in line everywhere else. And so it can be a little bit – so for some of our guests, it's a little disconcerting, especially the first time they walk into the room. And it is quite a large sanctuary with the tables, and we have music playing, and there's artwork around, and it's quite a scene sometimes. And that can be a little disturbing for some of our folks. We're trying to make sure that if people come in that moment where they stop and, you know, their eyes are, you know, getting big as saucers, we go over and talk to them, and they want to know where they're supposed to sit and what they're supposed to do, and we tell them they can sit anywhere they like. And that is often a little bit disconcerting at first, and so we like to spend some time with them. We're also very aware, more and more now, acutely aware, as we have more what are now called returning citizens, people who are leaving prisons. And for them, we have to be very careful, because Too many choices can also be traumatic when they've been in a situation where their choices have been severely limited. And here we are giving them choices. They can sit in where they want. They can come anytime they want. Those kinds of things. So we try to work with them to reassure them that it's okay. You're going to be all right. So we're learning from them, you know, how to engage with them in ways that is truly hospitable. And, you know, hospitality is a very dynamic engagement. It's not the same for everyone. So we have to be really aware of what is truly hospitable in that context. So it takes constant learning on our part to see what does radical hospitality mean to that person who's walking in the room, not necessarily what does it mean to me theoretically, but how is it implemented in the moment.
That's a wonderful point, a realization that a restaurant probably doesn't have that sensitivity. But you add to the traditional hospitality a recognition of the distinctiveness of each person, and you're addressing that as well.
Well, that's our aspiration. I think that, I mean, this is not new. I mean, we always like to think that we're the latest thing. I think that, you know, the Benedictines have been doing this for centuries. You know, that's
yeah.
Their, you know, and so, you know, we're trying to add our iteration to a very long tradition of what it means to be a guest and what it means to be a host. And it's a very complicated relationship when you really delve into it.
Say more about the complication of the guest-host relationship in the context.
Sure. And especially in this situation when we're dealing with very vulnerable adults and who have come in, there's an intriguing power dynamic, and we have to really work to balance that as best we can. It's not going to be perfect balance because in that moment it can become transactional if we're not careful and if we're not really paying attention. You know, there are certain needs that people have, and there are certain capacities that we might have to fill those needs. And it's very, very easy to get into a very complicated, I think, damaging power relationship. And that's why we really speak about scarcity as the trauma, not about, being homeless or homeful or things like that, or being necessarily being hungry or being poor or being rich. One of the things that we're paying attention to is that, and this is where we work with our staff more and more to be truly trauma-informed, is to say that one of the universal human conditions, we believe, is to experience scarcity. I mean, even the wealthiest benefactors we have, they even talk about how they don't have enough time. You know, they have plenty of money and they have great resources, but we all experience scarcity in different ways. And with our guests, we're aware, you know, I often tell folks in our orientation with volunteers, you know, that every time, and I think this is every time that I go to the airport to catch a flight and I'm in that TSA line, I have a moment where I think I'm going to miss that flight. You know, I don't have enough time. This line is moving too slowly, and I go through the whole mental gymnastics about scarcity. And this time, I'm going to miss that flight. There's no more flights. It's going to really wreak havoc on my, you know, my work or my vacation. And then I calm down. I watch the line. It's moving okay, and I'm going to make it. And you know, in the, whatever 15 years or so the TSA has been doing what they've been doing, I've never missed a flight. But I always think about that possibility. And then I entertain with our volunteers, say, imagine if that moment or that 30 seconds that I go through of the mental gyration, imagine if that's my entire week. Imagine if that's day after day. That's all I'm thinking about. And that's the trauma of chronic scarcity that is very different for our vulnerable adults who are living in that moment. And that's the difference that we believe makes the difference. It's the relentlessness of the scarcity, not just the experience of it.
It's also very visible. Where most of us are scarcity, we make invisible.
Exactly. We're masters at covering it, and our guests are they're beyond that. They've let that go.
You know, you talk about waiting in line. It's not only that you wait in line and wonder if you're going to make it, but when the reward at the end of the line is to empty your pockets and raise your hands. And I always feel like I'm being arrested.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Ed, one of the things that you mentioned in this article that Peter mm-hmm. called Seeing Blue, mm-hmm. is how you came to see things that you hadn't seen before, even though they were all around you. One of the things I think that our book, The Abundant Community, is trying to help people see is that very thing, that there is in the locality an abundance, but we don't see it because we are, in a sense, blinded by the institutional consumer world.
Yes.
And I was wondering, do you have a way that you could tell other people that might be a praxis that would help someone see what is there, have the experience that you had that led you then to the kinds of actions you take? How can we see?
Well, for me, you know, part of my meditation practice is having a softer focus of widening my view. Historically, for me, I've been, you know, as a therapist in my previous incarnation, I'd be working in a very small room in a therapy setting, and it'd be a very narrow focus. So I'd be very focused on the client, on myself, and the client's family, but it'd be very, very tight. And in this work, it's really about softening the focus and really widening the view and being able to let in more, not just information, but more experience, to be able to and then I just keep asking myself, what am I not seeing because I'm looking too closely? And to begin to suspend my judgment about knowing what is in front of me. And I think that there's a real value to sitting in the practice of not knowing, and allowing what is occurring to just enter into my consciousness rather than me trying to find something out. So it really is an uncovering rather than a discovering.
You think you discovered as you talk about your sort of discovery of the meaning of a line, was a part of that discovery looking inside yourself? You didn't have to read about it. Your own humanity helps you, once you see it in relationship to others, to see the others.
I think that's right, John. I think there's also an awareness of, you know, of what the relationship is like in the moment. For instance, we have when I first took over the orchestrating the Breaking Bread meals, we still do. It's a clothing closet that we have. You know, people can go in and choose some items of clothing. And when I first took over, we had it was a first come first serve, and we could serve about 40 people. And our Thursday lunch the doors would open at 11:30, and about 9 o'clock, sometimes earlier, people would be literally lining up in front of the building. And when we would open the doors, they would be racing up the stairs, and quite literally, sometimes stepping on each other to be first in line. And our folks were not violent or mean-spirited. They were just desperate. They were desperate for a pair of pants. They've been wearing the same clothes for 3 weeks. That's all they could think about. And so, you know, just to be aware, I just became aware of how untenable that was for me, that I, to watching and to be part of that, and to be in some ways, you know, a co-conspirator in allowing that to happen was just untenable to me. So we had to find a new solution, and we finally came up with a lottery. It wasn't that brilliant, but just to be able to use some game theory. So we took out so there was no first come, first serve. And so almost immediately, I would say within a week or two, that line disappeared, and people started coming later because it didn't matter whether you came in 1 minute or 10 minutes after, because the lottery would be there. So we were really looking at ways for us to be noticing our own experiences, our own sense of awkwardness, our own sense of this is just this is not a host guest relationship. This was something more conspiratorial, where we were, and I think there was a sense of shame in the whole thing that we found to be unspeakable. And so I think as we began to speak our experiences, saying this was not how we wanted to live our lives, this is not how we wanted to engage with our guests, then we were forced to look at new ways of looking at the room and looking at our relationships, and then looking at new possibilities.
You know, as the more you talk, Ed, the more I feel that your guests are transparent in the conditions that we're all living in. If you think of Black Friday, you see people stomping over each other to get the filing space.
I believe that's exactly right, Peter. I believe that's exactly right. Yes.
And you know, John and others, the consumer assumption, the consumer culture is based on the fact that no matter how much I have, it's not enough.
And that's the mantra we have. I love your abundant communities and a sense of abundance, and we've learned that is a very complicated language about abundance, because it's experienced in different ways. You know, in our early days, we used to have huge bowls of fruit on the tables, because our sense, I like to say, when we were equally well intentioned and ill informed in equal measure, we thought we would have, if we had like massive amounts of fruit overflowing on the tables, that people would be so happy to see all this fruit. And it really did traumatize our guests, because, you know, when you're living in that kind of chronic scarcity, you know, and again, as we spoke with them and learned from them, it's, of course, then it made sense. And at first we couldn't figure out what's going on, why it was so tense. And if your experience of yesterday was that there was not enough, and your experience today is that there's more than you could imagine, then your thought tomorrow is there won't be anything, so I better hoard as much as I can, right? So that was our learning, to really, so we don't stack servings, we do third servings, we do one serving a meal for each person. We always just say that there's exactly enough. There's never more or never less than enough. And I think that has some, although we're not a religious organization, it does have some spiritual component, that our colleagues from the faith side, you know, talk about the manna of the Israelites, that didn't refrigerate well. There was always just enough. You couldn't you couldn't store it. And so there's a sense of the abundance was in the moment, not an abundance over time. There was enough manna for everyone, and so there was an abundance, but it wasn't, you know, overflowing, and then you couldn't store it away and, you know, lock it up in a safe deposit box and worship it. And so abundance, even then, and I think as you talk about your communities, I think it's a very deep sense of, you know, abundance doesn't necessarily mean surplus.
The power imbalance, you know, John and I are always kind of, and a lot of other people, raising the question of charity and philanthropy, mm-hmm. as if I'm whole and you're not, as if I'm well and you need fixing.
Yeah.
So the volunteers then are really the, as much the target or object or beneficiary of this radical hospitality as are your guests, aren't they?
Do they
get the point, or talk a little bit about the impact this has on them?
I think they do. I mean, we have an orientation before every meal, and we have a debrief afterwards, and we talk about their experiences, and we try to make ourselves as transparent as possible what we're doing, why we're doing it. And the other piece that's very important, I think, that we encourage our volunteers, which is a little different than some organizations, and I know when I go and volunteer someplace, often I can be guilty of this as well. I want to be very hyper-productive. I want to get in there, and I want to do some really hard work, and I want to feel really good about myself, and I want to leave saying I just did something really wonderful, and, you know, and I'm really tired and sweaty, and isn't it great? And with our volunteers, say, you know, that sometimes there'll be a lull in the meal, and there'll be some free time, and it's perfectly fine to sit down and chat with our guests, and, you know, we don't have to be busy to be really effective. And I think that also does change the way they think about how they can be in the room. So it's not just about doing, but it is about how you're going to be. And that has a profound impact on many of our volunteers, who say this is the first time that they've ever sat down with someone, you know, who they in the past would just, you know, walk by or be not know what to do or say. And it really is it's a transformative moment for many of our volunteers to be able to have that kind of, you know, very natural moment of conversation and of sitting at a table. And what could be more natural and more normal and more human than sitting at a table, you know, literally breaking bread with another person?
Beautiful. You know, this what strikes me is how meaning and symbolism you create out of the everydayness of life. And I think that's just enormously powerful. And, you know, I don't know, John, if you told me this, but I read somewhere that if you ask the people that you're serving, your guests, what are they best at? What are they good at? The number one answer is, I know how to cook. And it always,
yeah.
I don't know what to do with that, but it just stunned me that the people in ministry, in the church, the thing they're most proud of and is most measurable is how many people they feed every week. One church in Cincinnati has a club, and it's called Club 5000 because they feed about 5,000 people in a year or something like that. And then when you think, my goodness, the people we're feeding know how to cook. I don't know. I just mentioned that, and you'll figure out some way to do something like that.
I think that's an important notion, Peter, that we talk about, too, among the staff as well, is that there is a sense of, in our field, it's very implied about how we continue to grow. You know, often our funders like to see year over year how many more meals we are serving and how many more guests come over. And it's a very it's a capitalist model. It's like sort of how many iPhones did you sell this quarter from last quarter? And, you know, and so, and in fact, when we take a softer view and step back and saying the fact that we are serving probably about 75 or 80,000 meals this year and last year we served 52,000 means that as a society we are failing by 50% every year that I grow and feed and have more people come in and be hospitable to more of our vulnerable guests, that means our city and our country is failing those people.
These are
markers of shame for me that I should be out of business.
Yeah. Well, and yet this is a positive sign to many funders.
Yes. They expect
it. The need increases and the funder is doing nothing about the cause, right? They are more than happy to increase funding for an increase in people who don't have food. It's just an endless self-serving hypocrisy.
Right. And then the question comes up that often comes up that I try not to laugh, but it's really, they'll ask me, is it scalable? You know, can I scale it? You know, it'd be like, well, at what point do you scale your Thanksgiving dinner before it ceases to be a Thanksgiving dinner?
Yeah.
What's that number? I don't know, but I know that there is a number when it stops being a Thanksgiving dinner.
You know, I consulted with Johnson & Johnson years ago, who make Band-Aids. And the president, John Walker, was a very wonderful man. And he looked at the group and he says, the only way we're going to increase sales of Band-Aids is increase the number of wounds.
Exactly right. Right, and that's a perfect metaphor for what we're doing. Yeah.
Ed, let me ask you one other question. I'll bet you people who are listening, some of them have in their mind, let's imagine you were in a place where you had 200 people who you'd like to offer hospitality, but in fact you only have 100 meals. You say you've never, you know, you always have an abundance, but I think we often hear of food pantries that have run out of food, of kitchens where there's more demand than there is supply. How do we deal with that?
That's a really difficult question, John. I think one of the premise of your question is probably where I would divert a little bit, because again, our focus is not on the food, and I think that's the way we have decided to enter into this space and enter into this conversation, is the focus is on how we are with each other. And so I'm sitting with people, not feeding people. So I think I would have maybe a different conversation than, and perhaps I'm not even sure how I would address that. But I don't think it's about just sort of splitting the atom. What we generally do is if we do not have enough for everyone, we would not open our doors. When we have a personal care, hygiene items of socks and underwear and various items, and we do an order fulfillment system, and if we don't have enough, if every single person ordered the same item, if we don't have enough to fulfill that order, we would not have that even on the order form, because we would have to have our belief is we would have to serve everyone. And that's not a perfect model, because we can see that, you know, Jefferson said half a loaf of bread is better than no loaf at all, and I think there is some sense of that. That's just not how we have decided to enter into this conversation.
Good.
Maggie, let's open for questions in a second, but somebody chat said, how do you relate to guests in the food hall who are a bit more psychotic than the rest of us? I think that all of us, you know, had images. Could you respond to that concern?
Well,
that
I just saw that. I love the way the question is framed, who are a bit more psychotic than the rest of us, and I think that's exactly right. I think part of it is to remember, you know, as my Unitarian friends say, is I am that too, is to be able to, you know, we do have a number of people who have some serious mental health issues. And most of the time we do a harm reduction model where we're making sure that people are safe and we have a high latitude for, let's say, aberrant behavior, as long as, you know, there's a safety concerns are well taken care of. So we tend to not be particularly confrontational, and we're not worried about how we look. You know, sometimes some of our guests will say things and act in a way that's very bizarre, and we are very careful to let our volunteers know and expect to see that and to hear that, and to knowing that quite often and most of the time, almost all the time, that those folks are quite safe, even if they say some very scary things. And the key for us is the same key we've been talking about, is relationships. Most of the time, we know those folks, and we can engage with them, and we can begin to marshal some of their resources. And for some of the folks, it's how they've learned to navigate in the world. If they see an option, they can often look for it. So we have a fair number of people with some significant mental health issues, but we have not called any law enforcement into a breaking bread meal in over 6 years. And so I think that's something that we strive towards, to make sure that our folks are safe. And I think there's an expectation, and if we create an environment where people do have that. And quite often many of our guests will take care of some of the other guests without us having to intervene. That's been working for us for a long time. So, but we pay attention to it every day. And we try to make sure that we're intervening when there's a stressful situation as early as possible. So all of our staff are trained in crisis management to be able to see things sooner. In the old days, we would come in when someone who was experiencing some illusions and delusions, that we would come in way too late into that moment. So now we are able to intervene and to engage with those folks much earlier than we used to be.
Beautiful. So, Maggie, I'm wondering if we should open it up in case somebody would like to ask a question.
Absolutely,
you want to invite people in?
I would. If you would like to call in with a question or a comment or reflection, please do so by hitting *8 on your telephone, and you'll be put into a queue. And if we've got some comments going on in the chat room, feel free to put a comment in there, and we do have a caller. I'm going to take the call from California. Just a second. Hello, California.
Hi, this is Susan Clark from San Rafael, California, and I really want to thank you for this wonderful discussion. And I apologize, I wasn't in at the top of the hour, so you might have already spoken to this, but the point you just made about how if a situation comes up, some of the guests help take responsibility for working through it. I was curious, what role, if any, do certain guests help in playing in how you arrange the experience or how this wonderful organization evolves over time?
Well, that's a great question, Susan. Let me address it in two ways. One is I can give you a very short anecdote. Once we had a gentleman who was very new to our breaking bread meal, and he stood up and he began to sort of quote unquote act out, and he was very, you know, dramatic in his acting out. And as I was walking to the table, one of the guests next to him just said, "That doesn't work here," and the gentleman just stopped right away and sat down, and it was a wonderful moment where to see that, you know, our guests can see some things that I thought I was dealing with somebody with a severe mental illness, and I was actually dealing with someone who has been surviving and has a way of surviving. So sometimes it's even we're not sure what we're encountering, but our guests are so smart, and they are and they see things that we can't see. So there is that. That's one aspect. I think the other piece is, and this speaks to our roles as guests and hosts. A lot of people ask us, like, shouldn't the guests that we have, shouldn't they be doing some work? Shouldn't they be coming in and doing some of the volunteer work, et cetera? And we've looked at that, and that hasn't worked well for us because it does blur those lines, and especially for many of our folks living in chronic scarcity, there would be an expectation that if I do something, if I'm volunteering in the moment, then I would expect to get something in return that would be more than someone who is a guest. So the way we have dealt with it, I'm not sure it's ideal, but our mantra is that you can be a volunteer or you can be a guest. You just can't be both on the same day. And you can choose your role, and that works. So some of our guests will volunteer, and then they have relinquished the access to the clothing closet or to personal care and to the meal that day, or they can join us as a guest. And so some of our guests will come in with the idea of volunteering, but then they'll decide, no, I really need the services, in which you say, fine, it's absolutely fine to relinquish that role and be a guest. A guest or a volunteer is equally valued to us.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful structure, Ed. Somebody on the chat says, does everyone eventually have access to a change of clothing? Respond to that question.
And that's a great question, too. And the answer is, unfortunately, no. And that's part of our scarcity. And, as our mutual friend Jill Janoff would say, sometimes we do catch our clients' disease or our guests, is we have a scarcity of time and scarcity of human resources with our volunteers and things to be able to keep the clothing closet open as much as possible. We're working on that to really expand that beyond the meals. And we have some wonderful volunteers who have organized our inventory, so we're able to get many more people. But no, I would say that one of the areas we're looking at very closely is how to expand that capacity without it, but still doing it in a way that is relational. So we don't just leave clothes out on a table for people to just pick through or such. That people go down in small groups, and we have personal shoppers that help them pick out clothes. We have some menders. Some of our wonderful women come from some of the churches nearby, and they showed up about 4 years ago, and they said that their spiritual practice was mending the world by mending clothes, and they asked us if they could do some mending. So our guests will come in, and they'll pick some clothes out. The clothes sometimes don't fit or something. The mender will hem them or fix them, or they can, fix their favorite jacket or whatever. So we really are, what we say at Broad Street, it's never about what it's about. So even the meals are not about the meals, and the clothes are not about the clothes, and even our mail service is not about the mail. We have 3,000 people who get their mail here at Broad Street. It's also not about the mail. It's about the relationship, and it's about all the things that can happen and all the opportunities that can be opened to them by having that sense of being anchored in a place and in a time. And so it's never about what it's about. And so the clothing closet is just not – it's not just about clothes. But we really do want to be able to expand those services whenever we can, and that's an area that we've been working on very carefully.
So let me ask Maggie, is there any other callers?
Yes, we do have one other caller, Peter. We have Frankie Lee. Well, invite on now.
Hello.
Hello,
Frankie.
Hi, Frankie.
Hello.
Hi, it's good.
Do you have a question?
Yes, that's why I'm calling.
Okay.
It's actually part of the conversation, I guess. First of all, Ed, I just think it's very beautiful what you've distinguished. I've had similar awarenesses. I've been on the road for over 4 years and lived in 114 homes.
My word.
And when you move in with people, their vulnerabilities show up in ways that our social selves often don't, And I feel like what you distinguished about time is such an important thing, it's not so much that people don't have time, it's that they have they're operating in isolation to a large degree, and so they orient to it as a scarcity. And I feel like when we come together at the next level, that that's the greater possibility. So I guess I'm actually really on the call because I called Peter over a week ago and I haven't heard back, and I'm aware that I'm feeling incredibly vulnerable about even trying again, and that that's become part of my scarcity, is to go beyond worlds.
Yes.
And then not be seen as within it. And how do we bridge that? So anybody that wants to address that, that would be great. I'd love to also connect with John because of my Northwestern roots, and what I'm working with goes all the way back to amazing course there. So there you have it. That's what I called in.
Let me know more on email.
Well, thank you. You know, your comments reminded me of years ago. Alan Watts once talked about the carpenter's apprentice. You know, the apprentice showed up and the carpenter said that there's no work today because they ran out of inches. And he really couldn't understand it because they had plenty of inches yesterday, but they just had a shortage of inches. So they just couldn't. And the story goes on and on. And it sounds, you know, quite crazy until you start imagine that if we just put in time, any time measurement, we said all the time, I ran out of time. And if we said I ran out of inches, we would say, well, that's insane. But we act as if running out of time is any less insane than running out of inches. So I think there is something about that scarcity, which is it's almost a default that we go to. It's that when we stop paying attention, I think we move into scarcity quite effortlessly. And I think the effort is to stay awake to what is in abundance and what is enough, and it's there all the time. But it's not our default consciousness. I think our default consciousness is to look for scarcity.
And time as an excuse for not paying attention.
Yes. I wish I had more time, you know, and suddenly
yeah.
Suddenly we have time, you know.
Your guess. Go ahead. Thank you.
When we're really present, you know, oftentimes there's a solution or a way to forward someone in the moment that can take really practically no time. But when we're orienting to the scarcity of not having enough time, it avails, you know, that moving forward, that forwarding action that could actually be the thing that would make the difference that affirms connection.
Yes, I believe that.
So, Ed, I want to, notice on as part of the ministry, you have a Center for Subversive Theology. And I have the feeling, I was going to ask you earlier, what do you mean by that? But I think I've been listening to it. Could you comment on that?
Well, I'm not on the theological side there, but I must say our theology and faith community really does a great job of helping inform us, and we have a lot of conversations back and forth about that. So I think that when we have the conversations about values and what are our principles and practices, I think that subversive theology is really about doing what we do every day. The ministers here by design, they made sure that their communion table is in the dining room, and we use that as the table where we do a lot of the administrative stuff. And it's by design. They want to make sure that what is occurring on Sunday at their worship is also happening during the week. And that doesn't mean that we have any religious obligations. There's no prayer before the meal. There's no criteria for admissions, like in some places where you have to listen to a sermon or something. So we're very secular in our approach, but from their point of view, that we are one organization, and we on this in the secular expression of that is just as vital part of the as the religious community as they are to us. So there's a way of holding both the sacred and the secular in a way that we think works and we think really makes the most sense.
It's also, they call it subversive theology, not subversive religion.
Right, right.
And so, I think what you're doing is an embodiment of that. It's very powerful. So any more questions, Maggie, before we can look at the chat, and then I want to kind of wrap it up?
No, there was just more callers, Peter. It's just a couple of comments in the chat.
Now, there's a question you can see on the chat, Ed. Can we use the idea of a softer focus deal with the larger community's compassion fatigue, with homelessness. And, you know,
I think you would be the ideal person to answer that question, Peter. You and John, not me.
Okay. Even the word homeless, you know, you talk about them as people who are experiencing kind of a vulnerable scarcity.
Yes.
I like every time, because these people are not homeless. I want to get your thoughts. I keep thinking that that's not who they are. You know, they may not know where they're sleeping tonight, but to call them homeless. Is dishonest in a way, because it's not. Could you comment on that language we use, you know, in this world of charity? And
I think that it's a very important notion, you know. And I think about it sometimes when I've worked with some of my clients who are particularly even damaged. This idea of home is also a very complicated issue. Many people have housing but no home. I know some people that are experiencing enormous wealth who are homeless. They don't have a sense of home. They have a sense of some of them don't even have a sense of place. So home is also a very, very complex social construct. And our folks, about 30% of the folks that we engage with are what we say living outdoors in the city. Another maybe, 70-80%, I'm not sure if I hit 100 yet, are living in some sort of housing or shelter insecurity. You know, they may not know where their next shelter is. And maybe 15, sometimes maybe 20% on any given time have what we would consider to be a stable housing situation. But they all come for a reason. And this is about what you folks are, you know, you and John are so adept at expressing. They come for a sense of community. This is where they belong. And so I believe that wherever you belong is where that is your home.
That's a wonderful way of defining it. And maybe your tables are becoming home for an awful lot of people because they are a place of hospitality rather than feeding.
That's our hope, John. Absolutely, that's what we hope.
You know, there's 100 other questions that I would love to ask you about, but I think this would be a good point. Would you, any point to kind of stop? Somebody asked about how you're funded, but you may want to comment on that quickly. Any final thoughts you have, Ted?
I'd be happy to talk about the funding. Most of our funding comes from several very, very wonderful prominent benefactors, and we have also a number of foundations who, and what we've learned is that when people come and visit us and see and experience what we're up to, then they have a sense of being part of what we do. And so we have no public funding; it's all private, and that allows us to be very experimental. And you know, we love to pilot things, Peter. That's we learned from you is you can't fail if you pilot because you're always learning.
Right.
And we think we're a learning organization.
Well, you are learning, but you're also, when we talk about social innovators and the way you reframe the common and the everyday in such a purposeful way, it's just, as soon as I read your article, after having been with you, I thought, wow, this is available to all of us. You know, and it's amazing work in hearing you talk about it, even more amazing. John, any final comments you want to make?
Oh, it's been a wonderful, informative discussion. Ed, appreciate your giving us your time.
Thank you very much, and to you, and also all of the people you're listening, they're listening or will listen later. A heartfelt welcome. Come if you're in Philadelphia. Come and see us and experience our hospitality. We'd love to meet you and to have you meet us and our guests. And that's a heartfelt invitation.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ed. Maggie, you want to bring us to a close?
Sure. Thank you, Ed, and Peter and John. This is really a great conversation. Appreciate your being with us today. And thank you, too, to our listeners. And hope you'll join us again next time. We'll be on October 6th, and our guest will be Paula Boggs-Muthing, who is city solicitor in Cincinnati. Also, this this conversation is archived and will be on our website soon. So until October, please visit our website, www.abundantcommunity.com, and stay in touch with us. This brings our program to a close today, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter,
bye-bye.
John, and Megan.
Thanks.
Great conversation. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Take care now.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.